This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the judges up the ante for Lynn Stewart as a fake Christmas terror plot unfolds. Just before Christmas, Wednesday, December 23rd, the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals releases an amended opinion on the resentencing of Lynn Stewart. It wasn't enough in its original November 17th opinion to require Judge John Codal to consider a much longer sentence for Lynn Stewart. He had given her a 28-month sentence. Now they are saying that he must reconsider the terror enhancement. The federal prosecutors had asked for 30 years, 30 long years. Today on Taking Aim, we continue with our discussion with Ralph Poynter. Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning.
We have news that you visited Lynn this time. They tried to keep you out once again, but thanks to the valiant efforts of your daughter, you were able to see Lynn. Please describe what happened.
We all know about my son, the doctor. Now I have a story of my daughter, the doctor, because I was told that when I had my double knee operation, that it would set off machines, you know, through airports or any security place. And when I asked about the prison, they says, oh, yeah, it'll set off the machine, but the hand wand will show where the metal is. And, of course, I have my double 12-inch scars to prove it. The first time I didn't get a chance to go through the metal detector was last week. There was a problem. I had been turned down for the visit. Very disappointing on both ends. On my end, I will tell you, and I would imagine on Lynn's end. This week, we were short. Everything was in line. And as I went through the metal detector, they said, your knees. So I says, well, let me show you the scar. And they says, well, no, we believe it's your knees, but you have to have a card. So we stepped out and said, could we have a card fax from the hospital? No, there's no faxing. Could we get a fax from sent to a local establishment? No, it can't be done. You have to have the card in hand. So my daughter got in a cab and went to the hospital for special surgery while calling, giving them the fax and saying she was on the way to pick up my card. And I waited at the MCC facility. And 25 minutes later, in New York, from the bottom of Manhattan to 70th Street and back, she and her husband, I looked up and saw them running across the street. My heart sank because there was no smile on their face. They ran past me and waved me on with the card. And she, fortunately, had gone to Columbia University in the class 2 years behind the doctor who had done the surgery. They knew each other, and therefore she was able to get the pass for me. We went in. And as Lynn described it, some of the younger members had crawled up the side of the window and they could look down and see the visiting area. And they told her that I was there with our daughter. And when they called everybody down but her, she said it was some moment. She was very hurt. But then they called her down 10 minutes later and they took her through a different section of the prison. And as she walked through, the inmates applauded because she has a reputation for defending those who most need defending, and at a rate they could afford, and if they couldn't afford, as I said, she did more pro bono work in New York than legal aid. So she is much appreciated by a certain group of the population, politically aware people and people who have been helped. I can't tell you how wonderful it felt to see her and to feel her when she walked into the room.
Ralph, you were able to see Lynn for only an hour and a half.
About an hour and a half. We lost about 15 minutes on the question of my past. That's what makes you crazy in the prison. I had heard while I was sitting outside that I had a white shirt on and the white shirt was not allowed in. So then we ran out and bought another T-shirt, you know, of color. They list what you can wear and what you can't wear, but then that can change. And it's very disheartening, you know. But fortunately, I was in. Our visit was miraculously only 10 or 15 minutes short, because had my daughter not been there, I would have missed it again.
So they terrorize the prisoners and their families.
It is a situation where you wonder how they can transfer this attitude from the government to those who are charged with enforcing law and those who are charged with incarceration. It's a mean-spiritedness that not all people have it. There are those in the system that treat you like a human being, but they are few and far between. But I'd like to applaud them, you know, because they can make you feel better or an awful lot worse with a look or a comment.
Let's discuss this surprise amended ruling by Judges Robert D. Sack, John M. Walker Jr., and Guido Calabresi from the Second Circuit Appellate Court, because they had issued their decision on November 17th, and suddenly, that was a 125-page decision, suddenly they amended, and we now have a 199-page decision. While they were applauding Judge Codal, they were saying that he hadn't really considered whether Lynn had perjured herself because she had signed the special administrative measures and then defied them. And now they're saying that Judge Codal, while he had talked about a terrorism enhancement in his sentencing of Lynn Stewart, he essentially disregarded it by giving her a 28-month sentence, which they consider an unreasonable sentence. Is this unusual for judges to come up with an amended appellate decision once they had taken a couple of years to file their first decision?
Well, as I say, it's getting curiouser and curiouser by the moment, but this is not a child's story, so it doesn't get funnier by the moment. We began to question again, and I have always questioned the government's statements as to what type of government is and what their aims and objectives are. And we see, along with this amendment, as you had mentioned, now we have another crazy bomber who can't make a bomb, and all of the situations around that. It gets curiouser and curiouser. When we look in the history of Judge Sack and Judge Walker, it gets curiouser and curiouser, and I would like for you to expand on that.
Well, we certainly intend to, and Ralph, one of the aspects of this coordinated timing, reflecting indisputably the political exigencies and agenda of those who rule, the ruling class. These judges reflect an agenda. The extraordinary act of amending an appellate ruling that had been lengthy and extended, however flawed, however based on falsehood it may be, it was complete. And now, suddenly, to make an amendment which further adds arguments for basically putting Lynn away for decades, not for months, reflects that's a political act. It's not only, as we were indicating, the sudden advent on Christmas of a supposed attempt of the Northwest Flight 253, which we will discuss. It's also the fact that Obama has declared that Yemen is a nest of Al-Qaeda and has to be part of the military agenda of the United States. It's also the fact that on December 31st, the key provisions of the Patriot Act are supposed to be, with the support of Obama, they're going to be ratified. All the most outrageous aspects of the Patriot Act come up for renewal on December 31st, and although there will be some legislative delay, the fact is that December 31st was the target date, and we cannot separate these events from the sudden orchestration of the theme of terror, 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 and demonizing Lynn Stewart in the process through this unusual, out-of-the-ordinary action of the appellate judges. And we're going to look at who are these people, who in fact are the poobahs of the court, who arrogate to themselves the right to flaunt their own rules and procedures in this quite obvious and political manner.
And I think we have to note that while they shout terror, 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 they continue to pick the pockets of the American people, the taxpayer. They continue to move the money upward. And I think we also have to notice that they always find terror, terror in a place where there's to be an oil pipeline or a discovery of oil.
Yes.
And the confluence or the coming together of these two facts, money, 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 products, raw materials, raw materials, raw materials, terror, terror, terror. And I think that they have been very successful so far. And let's see if they can get past the American people while they're shouting terror and stealing their health and wealth at the same time.
So I'd like to mention here, in having read the appellate decision three times, that I'm impressed by how the judges recreate history and weave a tale that has no relationship to reality, but also how they interpret the law in these decisions. They refer to the original Abdulrahman, the Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman decision in his conviction. And in that case, the judges had written, if the evidence shows that speeches cross the line into criminal solicitation, procurement of criminal activity, or conspiracy to violate the laws, the prosecution is permissible. And it goes on to say, words, quote, that instruct, solicit, or persuade others to commit crimes of violence violate the law. Now, let's look at this. I continue with the quote. And may be properly prosecuted regardless of whether they are uttered in private or in public speech or in administering the duties of religious ministry, end quote. This means that in the privacy of your own home, you cannot have a free-floating discussion. That is what they are ruling.
But I want to take up the point you just made, Ralph, with respect to the underlying economic realities of this fake war on terror. Because what you've been indicating has been vindicated here by a statement from the U.S. intelligence chief on the 13th of February. Economic crisis, a greater threat to terrorism, stated Dennis Blair, Obama's intelligence chief. The growing economic crisis has become the greatest threat to our security, meaning those of the rulers, outpacing even terrorism. I want to begin with the global economic crisis. It looms as the most serious in decades, if not in centuries. These economic crises increase the risk of regime-threatening instability if they are prolonged even for 1 or 2 year periods. And this instability can loosen our fragile hold on law and order, which can spill out in dangerous ways in the United States and in the international community. And he goes on in this fashion, in which he states there will be a backlash against the free market. What is he talking about here? That the people will rise, that the struggle for liberation will identify who are those in charge that create immiseration and poverty, where 1% of the population owns more than 95% of the rest of us combined. The category of terror is designed to deflect us from understanding that reality, and it is catching up with them as this economic crisis overwhelms them and as capitalism is in a process of rapid and terminal decay. That's the underlying reality that requires them to demonize Lynn Stewart. That's the requirement here of anyone who defies the rulers and who defends those who are falsely accused, as in the case of the blind Egyptian cleric Abdulrahman, who they are also demonizing in this amended ruling, where they call for an enhanced terrorism category for Lynn Stewart because of the fact that the blind Egyptian cleric was asked whether the ceasefire in Egypt, a ceasefire between the Egyptian government of Hosni Mubarak, who is the favorite recipient of rendition kidnapped political activists by the Central Intelligence Agency, renditioned or sent to Egypt for torture. The Mubarak regime is one of the most draconian and oppressive in the world. It disappears people overnight. They wind up tortured, and their families are tortured as well. And that ceasefire, which was violated by Mubarak, precipitated members of Sheikh Abdulrahman's political organization to ask him, should we abide by the ceasefire as the government violates it? And what was his response? That is a decision you are on the spot have to make. It is your call. You are not obligated if the government breaches the ceasefire, but you have to make that determination for yourselves. And Lynn Stewart, as his attorney, made public in a press statement, just as Ramsey Clark had done prior to that, as any good attorney does on behalf of their client, that is the rationale for categorizing both Sheikh Abdul Rahman and Lynn Stewart as terrorists involved in a criminal conspiracy. Indeed, these judges, these artful judges, compare it to a mafia boss ordering a hit from inside his prison cell.
Well, I must add, Ralph, that also in that release, it was stated that this was a ceasefire that was taken on by the Sheikh's old group unilaterally without the government signing on to it. And he said, we have entered into a ceasefire which requires us to stop talking about the injustices of the Mubarak government, to stop talking about the students being killed on campus, to stop talking about people who have been arrested and never tried, to stop talking about people who are incarcerated and never heard from again, to stop talking about if you were to choose to run against Mubarak, you will end up in jail. He has run unopposed for over 20 years. And this was his speech. It seems to me that we have no benefits, but you must make that decision. And that is a total of what this press release was.
Which is a political statement which anybody is entitled to make. And not only that, an attorney can disseminate any such statement and even approve of it within the right of free speech and the First Amendment in this country. So who are the violators of the due process and the law and the legal protections and the rights of the citizens of the United States? These very judges who uphold these draconian measures and enshrine them into law that violates our basic liberties.
Well, let's look at who are the judges in the appellate decision. The three members of the panel, Senior Judge Robert D. Sack, John M. Walker Jr., and Guido Calabrese. This information is available on the website of the Second Circuit Court and other sources on the Internet. Robert D. Sack, since August 6, 1998, has been a judge of the United States Court of Appeal for the Second Circuit. He was appointed by Bill Clinton. After graduating from the University of Rochester in 1960 and Columbia Law School in 1963, he became an associate and a partner at Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler. This is from 1964 to 1986. And later, he was a partner at Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher from 1986 to 1998. And both are in New York City. We need to look at the legacy of these two firms, Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, and Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, particularly Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler. Who are the notable alumni of this firm? Foremost is former Attorney General and former federal judge Michael B. Mukasey. He was a partner at the firm both before and after his accession to the bench, which happened in 1988. Let's look at the timing here. 1988, Michael Mukasey, a partner at Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, becomes a judge. But I had mentioned that Robert D. Sack was also a partner at Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, leaving in 1986. That means Mukasey and Sack were partners at this prestigious firm, a law firm founded in 1919, at the same time.
Moreover,
were partners together.
And before we amplify the partnership and the nature of Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, I want to emphasize here that the Michael Mukasey in question is not only the former Attorney General, not only a partner of Mayor Rudy Giuliani, not only a contributor to Giuliani's presidential campaign, but above all, he is the judge that rules in the matter of Jose Padilla and the torture of Jose Padilla, and he is the judge who rules in the matter of what? Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman. He is the judge who is ruling in the matters of the landmark plot attributed to Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman. He is the judge who is adjudicating the question of the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, the actions of Emad Ali Salem, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He is the judge at the heart of the role of Lynn Stewart as the valiant advocate for the falsely accused Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. He is the partner. I don't want to say partner in crime, but he is the partner in the law firm of Patterson, Belknap, and Webb and Tyler of Judge Sack.
Also, Ralph, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani was also a partner in this firm, and that's probably where Mukasey developed his close friendship with Mayor Giuliani.
Well, his
I don't want it to be missed that he was the judge in the Sheikh's trial that when Lynn defended the Sheikh. I don't know if you said that. I may have missed it.
Yes, and that is the critical importance of this is the following. Judge Sack had to recuse himself. He has a one-to-one conflict of interest. He is a partner, a senior partner of a major law firm with the very judge whose rulings were defended against by Lynn Stewart, who is the subject to this risk of incarceration for decades, on which Judge Sack is not merely pronouncing, but leading the charge in demanding an enhanced terrorist category for Lynn Stewart for an offense, which in fact is that of the Federal Bureau of Investigation itself, both with respect to the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, and with regard to the so-called landmark plot, because let's be clear about this.
Well, I don't like the quote law, Ralph, but I do believe that it is very clear when one recuses itself, or a judge or anyone in position of making the decision, the rule is that if there is an appearance of a problem, of an interest beyond that of the law, merely an appearance, that is the trigger for recusing oneself. And I think this goes far beyond an appearance, a mere appearance of one having a different interest or an interest beyond that which is stated publicly.
That's an important point, Ralph, and we're going to address Michael Mukasey's actual political views and as they bear upon the question of law and rights and liberties and the category of terror in a moment. But I want to mention another law firm in which Judge Sack is a partner, namely Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, a global law firm that has over 1,000 attorneys and 2,000 staff around the world. And its clients include the largest multinational corporations in all major industries, leading government entities, the major commercial investment banks in the United States, the startup ventures, the growth business partnerships. The attorneys and partners of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher represent the top corporations and banks in the United States. In fact, they rank nationally as the 300 leading corporate directors have stated that this is the law firm they most want representing their companies on national matters. They defended Intel Corporation against a multi-billion dollar antitrust lawsuit. They defended a conglomerate of international auto manufacturers, including Honda, Toyota, General Motors, Daimler, Chrysler, Ford, and Nissan, against a multi-billion dollar global warming lawsuit filed by the state of California. They represented the coalition of automakers, engine manufacturers, and dealers before the United States Supreme Court in Massachusetts, the state of Massachusetts, challenging their
the EPA,
the failure to abide by environmental requirements. In fact, the Gibson Dunn's Theodore Olson, who was another partner, not only argued on behalf of Daimler Chrysler, but Theodore Olson, the partner in this, represented George Bush in Bush versus Gore in securing the stolen election of 2000. Who are these people? 100 cases before the United States Supreme Court, representing a conglomerate of investment companies and the formation of joint ventures. They are the legal counsel for Lehman Brothers. They are the representative of General Electric and its 2 billion euro acquisition of Instrumentarium Corporation. And they represent the major insurance companies in Hurricane Katrina litigation as to whether the insurers were obligated to the people of New Orleans for the flood damage that devastated their homes and their lives. Who are these people who have the audacity to raise the question of the behavior of Lynn Stewart as an attorney defending the disadvantaged and the poor over a lifetime. These are the whores of the ruling class. That's who are the partners of these firms. They are the criminals of the society with the color of authority and the legitimacy of power.
And may as I say, the story gets curiouser and curiouser, but it gets clearer and clearer as to who is on whose side. These people, as you say, are those who are behind the picking of our pockets, and they are using this terror as a smokescreen. And who is on the side of the people, who has been on the side of the people for 40 years in her political career before being an attorney and after being an attorney, is Lynn Stewart. And it is clear why they are going after Lynn Stewart in this manner. And it is clear what our responsibility as the people are in fighting this. And thank you, Ralph.
And let's go on to Judge M. Walker, Jr. Or, Ralph, you first wanted to refer to Theodore Olson.
Yeah, I think it's important, Ralph, to bear out what you've been just mentioning, that a partner of Judge Sack is Theodore Olson. I mentioned that he had represented George Bush in Bush versus Gore. He also was the attorney for convicted Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard. Are we going to talk about defending terrorists here? We're talking about the Israeli state that is terrorizing the Palestinian people, and right now they have been indicted by the United Nations for removing the organs from Palestinian prisoners for coin. They are selling the organs on the open market of Palestinian youths and Palestinian prisoners and Palestinian detained, the Zionist state. In addition to which, Theodore Olson features as the Solicitor General, if you recall, at the time of the attacks of September 11th, speaking of terror, his wife, Barbara Olson, was a passenger on the presumptively hijacked American Airlines Flight 77 that we are told crashed into the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. Theodore Olson represented that his wife, Barbara Olson, a passenger on that plane, had alerted him to this by virtue of a cell phone telephone call she made. Much was made in the press about this cell phone telecommunication, which presumably described the hijacking of this plane. That never happened, because no cell phone can make a call from that altitude under those circumstances. These are the people who are inventing and engendering the false category of terror. And it is appropriate, Maya, that we look at Michael Mukasey in this context as well.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the judges up the ante for Lynn Stewart as a fake Christmas terror plot unfolds. Ralph, you wanted to continue with Michael Mukasey, who was a partner with Judge Robert Sack in Patterson, Belknap, Webb, and Tyler, the first firm at which he had a practice and later became a partner.
Well, Wikipedia writes the following. During his tenure on the bench, Mukasey presided over the criminal prosecution of Omar Abdulrahman and El Said Nusser, whom he sentenced to life in prison for a plot to blow up the United Nations and other Manhattan landmarks. Uncovered during investigation into the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Now, Mukasey, we're told, heard the trial of Padilla, Jose Padilla, ruling that the United States citizen and terrorist could be held as an enemy combatant. That is to say, he could be subjected to military control, to the torture to which he was subjected for 3 years and 8 months. And Mukasey did more than that. Quote, former AG Mukasey, terror cases don't belong in federal court. Attorney General Michael Mukasey criticized the Justice Department for its decision to prosecute five terror suspects in federal district court in Manhattan. He called the move unwise, not because it would be a show trial, brothers and sisters, because he said it risks creating sweeping new law that would allow those accused of terror to be heard in civilian courts. He opposes that. He says there should be a parallel court system in which those accused of crimes against the state and terror are treated, as he puts it, as if they were mentally deficient with a parallel system of justice. This he wrote in the Wall Street Journal on August 22, 2007. Jose Padilla makes bad law. He wrote, and I'll just conclude with this particular point because there's much to say about the likes of Mukasey. But he said that those who are treated and charged with crimes of terror or endangerment to the state should not be allowed to have civilian trials or due process or lawyers or the right to access the evidence that is being produced before them. On the contrary, there should be a parallel system of justice in which we create a separate national security court with the full gamut of national security issues from intelligence, in which it is the legal standards deployed are akin to handling the commitment of the mentally ill.
Sounds like the Inquisition all over again to me, Ralph. But you could tell us more about that.
I think we need to go further into Mukasey's opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal, something to which we have turned in prior Taking Aim programs, because it really reflects upon the Second Circuit appellate ruling with reference to Lynn Stewart. Very similar language. Mukasey writes that when Padilla was first arrested, he was not detained on a criminal charge. Rather, he was arrested on a material witness warrant under a statute that's more than a century old in the United States that authorizes the arrest of someone who has information likely to be of interest to a grand jury investigating a crime, but whose presence to testify cannot be assured. And at the time, the federal grand jury in New York was investigating the supposed activities of Al-Qaeda. This is what Mukasey writes. On May 8, 2002, Jose Padilla was seized at the Chicago airport. Mukasey, quote, "The material witness statute has its perils because the law does not authorize investigative detention. The government had only a limited time in which to let Padilla testify, prosecute him, or let him go. As that limited time drew to a close, the government changed course. It withdrew the grand jury subpoena that had triggered his designation as a material witness, designated Padilla instead as an unlawful combatant, and transferred him to military custody." What Mukasey goes on to complain about essentially is the fact that there is no investigative detention and that there is no ability for the government to just hold somebody. At the same time, he complains about, quote, "the inadequacy of the current approach to terrorism prosecution. One, he is dismayed by the fact that in the Landmarks trial, among others, the government had to reveal the names of people that it considered as the defendants. And this gave these defendants the ability to know who they were. They weren't brought to trial, but they were still named. Also, he mentions that the government has to disclose its sources and its information, and he doesn't like that. He is in support of secret evidence. And again, in the Lynn Stewart appellate decision, it upheld the government's right to call various evidence secret and for the defendant to have no right to examine this evidence. What do we have here? Certainly nothing that resembles a democratic approach to governance in the United States.
Michael Mukasey, when he appeared before the Senate for the nomination hearings pertaining to his becoming the Attorney General of the United States, was asked 495 questions with respect to the question, the matter of torture. He refused to declare that he considered waterboarding to be improper. He refused to declare himself in any definitive way on the matter of torture. And on the contrary, he upheld the opinions and views of John Yoo, the co-author of the Patriot Act, and of various memos in which he advocated the legality of torture. And I have to mention the following. At an important conference in Chicago, at which a law professor from Notre Dame University named Douglas Cassell asked John Yoo the following. If the president deems that it is appropriate to crush the testicles of a 10-year-old child in the presence of his father in order to extract information from the father, is that something that is permissible? And the response of John Yoo said there is no law or treaty to prevent it. Is there no moral impediment? Is there nothing to prevent the President of the United States from carrying out such an action, either in the Constitution or in the matter of propriety? John Yoo's response is, it's entirely dependent on why the President considers it necessary to do that. This is in a public arena, and John Yoo went further. He went further and stated that the question as to whether the torture of children is feasible or permissible is strictly a matter of why the president deems it necessary, choose to do so or not. Seymour Hersh commented that the government is withholding the tapes of the actual torture that has been carried out because of the horror of the soundtrack of shrieking boys and their mothers begging to be killed rather than see their children raped and tortured. This is the reality of these judges and their affiliations and their partnerships and their role in this society. And they are presiding upon an attempt to railroad Lynn Stewart into prison on the grounds of a supposed enhanced terrorist consideration. Who are these people? Criminals in the guise of judges' robes.
Let's go and look at another judge in the Second Circuit panel ruling on the fate of Lynn Stewart. Judge John M. Walker, Jr., U.S. Circuit Judge of the United States Court of Appeal, who was appointed in 1989. At the time of his appointment to the appellate court, he had been a U.S. District Judge in the Southern Court of New York. He served in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserves from 63 to 67 during the Vietnam War. From 66 to 68, he was state counsel to the Republic of Botswana under the aegis of the Africa-Asia Public Service Fellowship. He was in private practice, and then from 1970 to 75, he was an assistant U.S. attorney in the criminal division of the Southern District Court of New York, which means he was the federal prosecutor in the very district in which Lynn Stewart was tried. And then he returned to private practice with the law firm of Carter, Ledyard, and Milbourne, where he became a partner. We'll discuss that law firm. But after that, in 1981, he was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. That is, he served in the United States government.
And his law firm was representing American Tobacco, Standard Oil, DuPont, American Express, and the American Stock Exchange, the Fox Sports Network, and Union Bank Suisse. These are the great banks that have been participating in the financial swindles that led to $23.7 trillion being handed over to these banks by the United States authorities under President Obama. The whole American economy is $12.5 trillion. $23.7 trillion is the little beginning of the cannibalizing of the infrastructure of our entire society. That's who these judges represent. They are partnership in law firms that are part of the infrastructure of the ruling class of the United States. They put on robes and then they pronounce upon those who defend the helpless, who defend the oppressed, who defend the exploited. The Lynn Stewarts, our Mother Courage, are their target.
Their target, and what they are saying is that attorney Lynn Stewart, with over 30 years defending the oppressed, and much of that defense, as Ralph Pointer mentions, was pro bono, that Lynn Stewart committed a federal crime of terrorism. And as such, the terrorism enhancement should have been considered in greater depth than was done so by Judge Codal. And that Judge Codal was, in fact, setting aside many of the enhancements that would have led to a sentence of 30 years, the statutory maximum. Instead, he concluded that a sentence of 28 months imprisonment, quote, was sufficient, but no greater than necessary to accomplish the purposes in the federal guidelines.
May I say that this inquisition period that I'm talking about is a period where you could be arrested, tortured, your property stolen, and there would be no recourse to this situation, no mechanism to save you. This is what these judges and people in charge have brought upon us and are attempting to extend. A reincarnation of the Inquisition, where the government can do no wrong and they will trample every supposed right economic situation that we have struggled so many years to attain asunder.
I want to mention as well, Ralph, that we had planned today to examine the terror plot that was attributed to this young 23-year-old Nigerian on Christmas, Umar Abdul Muttalab. There are many important facets of this, not the smallest part of which is that his father, in October, had notified the United States Embassy and United States Intelligence Services that he considered his son to be engaged in embracing religious extremism. Now, it's interesting to note that he had not been in touch with his son for over a year. But amongst the many things, and we will have to address this in much more detail in a subsequent program, when the young man of 23 decided to fly to the United States to Detroit, he went to Nigeria first. He went to Nigeria on the 24th of December in order to take a flight of the same date back to Amsterdam and on to Detroit. Not only that, but he was on a terror watch list that was supposed to target those who were reported to be engaged in so-called terrorism, the U.S. intelligence services maintaining this meticulously. In fact, not only that, but there are nearly 1 million people who are on no-fly lists, it should be noted, and that includes people who are merely writing books or even former Senator Ted Kennedy. Now, when this young man who is on a terror watch list lands in Amsterdam and wants to board the plane to Detroit, we learn, he doesn't have any credit card. He produces $3,000 in cash to buy his ticket, and he lacks something else we now learn, namely a passport. So when the official of the airline, Northwest Airline for Flight 253, notifies this young man that you do need a passport to take an international flight, he produces a gentleman who claims that this young man's from the Sudan, who says, well, it's difficult to get passports into Sudan, so you should let him on this flight. According to the press reports, he is allowed on the flight under these circumstances. There's a great deal more that we will begin to describe and to unfold with respect to the realities of this so-called terror plot. But it has all of the earmarks of the hands of U.S. intelligence over it. And it is particularly significant that it is ascribed to Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Al-Qaeda in Yemen, where Obama has declared that the United States is intending to launch attacks on Yemen, and where it emerges that nonstop military assaults, including an air assault that killed 120 people, had been unfolding in Yemen on the part of the United States, previously denied. And what is at work in Yemen? There has been a struggle in Yemen dating back to the 60s. I visited, actually in 1963, King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, at which point King Faisal was engaged in bombings in Yemen. The movement of resistance at that time was called Marxist. Today it is called terrorist. The movement is the poor. The movement is the hungry. The movement is those peasants who don't want to accept the exploitation of oil companies, who challenge the feudal elite of the North. We will describe the civil war in Yemen and the role of the United States in upholding the oppressors and demonizing those who resist them as what else but terrorists.
Stay tuned, because there is more to hear. It gets curiouser and curiouser, and this is not a child's story. Be sure to listen in, because I can hardly wait for next week.
Ralph, could you please give us once again Lynn's address?
Lynn Stewart, MCC, 150 Park Road, 2 South, 2S, 53504-054, New York, New York, 10007. 53504-054, 150 Park Row, 2 South, Lynn Stewart. Please write with a return address so she can answer your questions and give thanks for your time that you have taken to consider this issue.
Thanks, Ralph. And I'd like to mention that we won't be on next week. We're taking a brief vacation, and we will return in 2 weeks. Next week, we'll replay one of our significant programs. We're entering our 9th year of Taking AIM. To return to the issue of Yemen, the military operations, that the major offensive that's been launched in Yemen, has been dubbed Operation Scorched Earth. Imagine a title such as that, Operation Scorched Earth. Now, the United States has been denying its involvement in the recent attacks, the attack to which Ralph referred, where 120 people were killed. Only it hasn't told the Yemeni security representatives to be on the same page.
In the aftermath of this fake hijacking attempt, Senator Lieberman has called for a preemptive attack on Yemen. Senator Arlen Specter has joined in his calling for an immediate attack on Yemen. Not only are Lieberman and Specter engaged in this saber-rattling, Barack Obama has announced that he will never rest until he has brought justice to those who have been responsible for menacing the homeland in the United States on Christmas Day, meaning that he intends to escalate the U.S. attacks in Yemen. Who are the real terrorists? It is increasingly clear to all who have eyes to see.
Obama's exact words were, quote, "We will not rest until we find all who were involved and hold them accountable." This was a serious reminder, referring to the Christmas Day supposed attempt to blow up a Northwest Airlines jet. He says, "This was a serious reminder of the dangers that we face and the nature of those who threaten our homeland. We will continue to do everything that we can to keep America safe in the new year and beyond." But referring once again to Yemen and the security forces and the U.S. denial that it has been providing military support, Press TV on December 27th, the Yemeni national security chief has declared that the country is receiving assistance from the U.S. in the crackdown of what he called al-Qaeda operatives in southern Yemen. Mohammed al-Ansi told the Saudi Arabian newspaper Okaz that Yemeni forces were cooperating with the U.S. military on attacks against al-Qaeda camps. I'd like to mention here that these al-Qaeda camps were two mosques. Yemen's confirmation comes as an ABC report revealed that the U.S. President Barack Obama had signed the order for a recent military strike on Yemen in which scores of civilians, including children, were killed. Now, this was an ABC television report. Upon the orders of Obama, the military warplanes blanketed two camps in the north of the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, on December 17th, claiming, quote, "an imminent attack against a U.S. asset was being planned." ABC News quoted anonymous administration officials as saying this on December 18th. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the United States had been denying that it was engaged in a full-scale military attack on Yemen. UPI carried the following story on December 16th. U.S. denies military role in Yemen. Washington denied its military forces were involved in the Yemeni conflict with rebel fighters in the north and in the south. The next day, the Daily Star in Beirut carried the following. Yemen rebel state, American Air Force is behind raid that killed 120. Shiite rebels accuse the United States Air Force of joining attacks against them and killing at least 120 in a raid in the north of the poor Arab state. This savage crime is but the continuation of the American Air Force attacks upon us across the entirety of our country. Here is the article by Jason Ditz on December 18th, U.S. attacking Yemen after all. After a very public denial that American forces were in the process of attacking sites across Yemen, President Barack Obama ordered multiple cruise missile attacks across this tiny coastal nations. The airstrikes were coordinated with the government of President Ali Abdullah Saleh, and then the following account occurs. Yemen rebels say that the U.S. Air Force is behind raids across Yemen that are killing civilians in village after village. Obama ordered U.S. military strikes on terrorists, a major escalation, says ABC News. What are the underlying politics of this? As Ralph indicated at the onset of this show, why, it is oil. There's been major, major oil reserves discovered across Yemen. And already they have been carved up in negotiations between Exxon, Mobil, and Total. The Hunt family is managing the offshore oil of Yemen. And Yemen, like Somalia, and by the way, Barack Obama cites Somalia as a repository of terrorism, the American embassy in Somalia is located in the offices of Conoco. The predicate of this whole category of terror is to rationalize the rapacious quest for the resources of people and for the maintenance of the conquest of all those who seek their national self-determination and their mastery over their own fate. The category of terror is the demonization of those who resist, of those who speak up, of those who will not bend the knee. Lynn Stewart has never done that. And that is why she is in their sights. That is why she is the poster child for those who would oppress us. And she indeed will be the very symbol of resistance then and now and in the future.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenemann
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the judges up the ante for Lynn Stewart as a fake Christmas terror plot unfolds. We'll be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Our best to you for the new year. We'll be with you soon.
Piki piki no biniye, tazan.